Welcome to the Insane Asylum.
And welcome back to the Insane Asylum. This is the Night of Living Dreads podcast, the podcast that covers all and anything horror. I am your host, Otis B. Dreads, and I'm flying solo, but that's okay. Mrs. Dreads is actually making some bread to bring home the bacon. You like how I did that? You see what I did there? You're picking up what I'm laying down. All right. But I got a good show nonetheless. I got a little article I want to talk about a movie that I just caught today. Just published over there at dreadcentral.com. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Going to play you guys. You guys are in for a little treat here. If you haven't heard it already, and I think it's really good, personally, that would be the theme song for the new Child's Play. And I like it. I actually like it more than I was anticipating to see the movie. But I'm going to go see it, as mentioned on last week's podcast. We are going to go see it and, of course, got to check it out. But a little theme song with Mark Hamill, who everybody knows, Luke Skywalker, is doing the voice of Chucky in this remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it. It's you can't really call it a remake, I don't think, because, it's all AI. I mean, this is a little computer doll. It seems odd to me. I'm not going to get into that because I went into it last week. Before we get into any of this, got to give out some horror love. Gorehounds of Horror. Over there on Facebook. Check them out. I'm over there. Otis B. Dreads. Hey, Mrs. Dreads is over there. My buddy Malice, who I'm hoping will, return here soon. He's been a busy little Malice. So, I'm not pressuring him. There's no pressure there, but he will be back soon. Gorehounds of Horror on Facebook. They got two groups. They got a closed group. They got an open group. Check them both out. Become members. Follow them. A couple other ones. We got Misfit Horror Fiend Club. As I've always said, if you like the Misfits and you like horror, this is your page. Ladies and gentlemen, great bunch of folks over there as well. After Dark. And again, as I've mentioned in the past, After Dark does a lot of the Facebook watch parties. So, if you want to really chill with some good people, some like-minded people that dig in horror and watch some movies and chat and have a good time. That's where you want to be, After Dark. And then, of course, the non-horror love for the group. That would be Cannabis Arcade. Cannabis spelled with a K. Burn one down. Have a few laughs. That's where you want to be. So, all right, tonight, going to talk. Like I said, I have a little article about a movie that's been given the green light. To start very, very early production November of this year. Also have, as I mentioned, the new theme music for the upcoming Child's Play. Coming out here in 3 days, it is the 18th of June. June 21st, Chucky comes to your town, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker. And also going to talk a little bit. Now, I know we, and this is probably a name that a lot of people have heard before, but it's still a very interesting story. I find the main topic of the night being Edmund Kemper the Third. I find him to be as interesting as the likes of a Ted Bundy. And we're going to get into that. Very, very crazy story. And not for the weak-minded or weak-eared. All right, here we go. There is a new movie that's been given the green light, as I said, to start what they call principal photography in November. Now, this is a movie called Amityville 1974. I'm actually kind of excited for this, and it hasn't even started, as I mentioned, principal photography yet. Before there, this comes from DreadCentral.com. I'll drop the link. You can, you know, if you want to read it for yourself. Before there was the Amityville Horror, there was the murder of the DeFeo family. Today brings word that a new chapter in the Amityville Horror saga is in the works, a prequel entitled Amityville 1974, which will begin principal photography later this year. Deadline.com broke the news stating, quote, "The Wonder Film Media Corporation announced today that Amityville 1974 has been given the green light to begin principal photography in November, with its story of the real-life rampage murders that would become the background story for author Jay Anson's 1977 bestseller, The Amityville Horror, and the numerous films that have invoked it in name or premise." In 1974, if you're not familiar with this, I believe Malice and myself did talk about this. In 1974, Ronald DeFeo Jr. killed his mother, father, and siblings in a shotgun rampage at the infamous house at 112 Ocean Avenue in the Amityville neighborhood in Long Island. He claimed he was commanded to commit the atrocities by voices in his head. There's a joke there. I just can't figure it out. So there you go. A little prequel, because if you have not listened to the podcast about Amityville and my impressions of Amityville, I personally think the Lutz family, I think they were making shit up, to be honest with you. And I'm not really convinced Ed and Elaine Warren, or Ed and Lorraine Warren, are all that credible either. I mean, for Christ's sake, Ed is a self-proclaimed demonologist. He didn't have much studying or anything going into that. So, yeah, I'm not really buying the whole Lutz story. I think the actual tragedy was what is, going to start a film project entitled Amityville 74. Again, that begins this November. So I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully, maybe sometime, I don't know, next year, maybe the beginning of 2021. Who knows? But I'm looking forward to it, people. Anyway, all right, here we go. There's a new theme for the Child's Play that's coming out, and as I mentioned, June 21st. I've been a little skeptical on it. Honestly, when I heard old Mark Hamill, good old Luke Skywalker, who is actually a very accomplished voice actor. He has done the voices as the Joker in the Batman cartoons. One of the many voices that have done that voice, the Joker and the Batman. So, you know, it's not out of his realm. He just don't swing a lightsaber, which, you know, maybe, some people may not be familiar with exactly what he's done in the past. And one being a voiceover actor. So, which probably explains how, he got the job for the voice of Chucky. Now, yeah, I was a little disappointed they weren't bringing some of the original actors back. We did cover an article in a earlier podcast about how some of the original actors weren't too happy about this. But hey, it is what it is. I'm still going to go see it. I was never a huge Chucky fan. It's hard to, because you, I guess you would kind of call it a slasher, but it's kind of hard to call a slasher when, as I mentioned, I think last week, when your slasher is like 2.5 foot tall. That's not really, you know, scary to me, but I get it. I get the premise. It's a little bit different now. But I think so far, I don't like how they change things with not being possessed by the likes of a serial killer, causing Chucky, the good guy, which is great. The irony is great. Serial killer, good guy. Good guy doll, I should say. They got rid of that. This is one of the best things that I have heard in a little bit. This is a really good theme. I like this theme. It has a lot of creepiness, and it also has Mark Hamill singing what's been, I guess, touted as the Buddies song. Take a listen.
Until the end, more than a buddy. You're my best friend. I love you more than you will ever know. I will never let you go. I am your buddy until the end. More than a buddy, I'm your best friend. When you feel lonely and you start to cry, I am always by your side. We are best buddies until the end. More than just buddies, we are best friends. Don't ever leave me, please don't say goodbye. I'll be yours till the day that you die.
Now, I know a lot of people, excuse me, are going to say, oh, well, he don't sound like, because he's not the original. He's not going to sound like the original. But I think Mark Hamill does a pretty decent job. Now, we haven't obviously seen him, you know, the movie, so we don't know how it's going to play out. I believe the creators of It, the newer versions of It, are the ones responsible for this. So maybe it won't be that bad. I was a little skeptical on It. But I'm actually looking forward to seeing It Chapter 2. I thought the music was creepy. It kind of got me a little pumped up, I guess. You know, the music with the little kids, you know, singing, that made me think of Children of the Corn, which was one movie that actually terrified me. I'm still scared to this day to walk into a fucking cornfield. Believe that. That's right. I am. I hate cornfields because of Children of the Corn. Here's a little inside note. I was actually going to name my son, who has appeared on the podcast, Malachi, from that movie, a movie that terrorized me as a kid. I couldn't go near a cornfield and still won't. I will not walk in a cornfield because of that movie. But anyway, I digress. We're going to talk some Edmund Kemper, as I mentioned, the third. But we're not going to do it quite yet. I have to set you up with song. You've heard this band before on this podcast, band called Macabre. And from what I've seen, I've watched an entire live performance on the tube. You can check them out. I know some people, they don't dig, you know, a whole lot of screaming and whatnot. This group, and I don't either. I'm not one of those, you know, if I can't understand the lyrics, I have a hard time getting into you because I'm a lyric guy. I like to hear what you're writing about, how you're projecting those lyrics. This is not really one of those bands, but this band, most of their songs are about serial killers. And it's a band that writes songs about serial killers. They're kind of a goof band, but they've been around for a minute. So to get you ready for a little bit of Kemper talk, here's Macabre. Edmund Kemper had a horrible temper.
I'm
Third, not a little guy, 6'9", 285, close to 300, 6'9", imagine that. He is the possibly the reason, I know this, I'm looking for a cheap joke here, I know the term probably came out before him, but getting some head. This guy should be absolutely credited with coining that. And we're going to get into that. Edmund Kemper. He was born December 18th, 1948. Had a killing spree that lasted between 1969 and 1973. Convicted of killing 10 people, including his paternal grandparents, as well as his own mother. His mother, Clarnell Elizabeth Kemper, she happened to be a California resident, was an administrative assistant at UC in Santa Cruz. His father, Edmund Kemper II, he was a World War II vet. And that didn't work out, you know, too. Well, it actually worked out actually pretty good. His mom, on the other hand, didn't like it. Edmund III Kemper, which we'll refer to him from this point on. His dad was a World War II vet, and after the war, he tested nuclear weapons over there at the Pacific Proving Grounds before returning to California, where he worked as an electrician. Now, this is one of the things that young Kemper, saw a lot in his early childhood. What he saw was his mom being what he called is a very angry, hungry woman. And it was said that she could have been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. She was very demeaning to young Kemper. She was also equally as demeaning to her husband, telling him things that, you know, like, oh, you're just a lousy, you know, menial, electrician job. That's all you have. You're not really that good for this family. Well, Kemper's dad, Edmund the third, or the second, I should say, decided he wasn't taking any more of that shit. He packed his shit and got out. Now, where did this leave young Kemper? This left young Kemper in the hands of this very mean alcoholic mother who was said to have some sort of personality disorder. I mentioned borderline personality disorder. I believe that is what they said she had. Leaves young Kemper with this woman. Now, this didn't work very well because Mrs. Kemper, Clarnell, well, she didn't change her ways much. Actually, her drinking increased. She became more demeaning to the point where she would actually put him in the basement and lock him down there because he had two other siblings. He had sisters, two sisters. Now, before I get ahead of myself, you know, the parents split in 57, which left Kemper at about age 9. Young age to have that happen. And he loved his father. He wasn't demeaning like his mother was. It was, somewhat of a decent relationship. But after his dad left, moved out because he couldn't handle her crazy, batshit crazy ways. His mother turns around, locks him in a basement at night. No type of light. She said it costs too much. You can't have a nightlight down there. So what he had down there was a furnace and a place to sleep. Now, young Kemper, as he got older in some prison interviews, had stated that he pretty much, at a young age, was looking at hell as he gazed into this furnace, which was raging. That was his basically only light. That and, well, there were rats, which he was scared to death of. Did not like that at all. But the reason that he was locked down there was because his mother felt, for some reason or another, that he would harm his sisters. Which seems weird. As batshit crazy as she is, she gets all ziggity-boo and, locking her kids. She pretty much hated him. I know it's weird to say that, a mother actually hates a child. I know it happens. But I think it was also said that, she wanted another daughter, and here comes this gargantuan. He was 13 pounds when he was born. A newborn, 13 pounds. He was a pretty big boy. And he only got bigger. Well, at 15, he decided he wasn't taking any more of this. I need to backtrack, though, actually. Him and his sisters, while he still was there, would play games like gas chamber, electric chair. Now, you can probably already assume what this is going to entail. This entails him being tied up to a chair, if they're playing electric chair, and one of his sisters, his elder sister, taking and pretending she's flipping the switch. He would then convulse in the chair as if simulating being electrocuted. Very weird behavior, to say the least. And his elder sister was not really. I think she kind of maybe had a little bit, too much of her mom in her, of their mom in her, because she seemed to have a hatred as well. One time, the elder sister tried to push him in front of a train. She successfully pushed him in the deep end of the pool where he almost drowned it. All right, so, or drowned, not drowned. The elder said, "Yeah, that you talk about a sibling rivalry here, okay? I don't know many people who have had sibling rivalries like this. I've fought with my brothers and sisters as well as anybody who has brothers and sisters, but I don't think it got to the point where they wanted to push me in front of a train or purposefully drown me. Seemed a little weird. Anyway, he's running away. He's tired of this shit. He's running away. 15. Now, his mom, where he was running away from, was in Helena, Montana. Now, he ended up running, and I'm assuming hitchhiking, at 15, got all the way to his father's house in Van Nuys, California. He was only able to stay there for, you know, a little while. He had been remarried, had a stepson, and, you know, there's not a lot of details on how that went down, but apparently it didn't work out very well because his mom sent him, or I'm sorry, his father sent him to his parents, his paternal grandparents. Now, they lived in North Fork. North Fork. And he always said that, you know, he seen his grandfather as, you know, just a senile old man. He didn't really, you know, think. Yeah, although he was the one person that investigators later on said that his grandfather, his paternal grandfather, that is, that he truly loved. He really did love his grandfather. There was a story where his grandfather bought him a gun, taught him how to shoot it. Unfortunately, that didn't work out very well because he started shooting birds and started, doing a little, target practice, I guess. And his grandmother is, again, his father's mother, did not approve of this. Now, she was said to be a lot like his mother, which is why, in his words, he says they never got along. They were, he said, matriarchal women. They were raised, I mean, just like putting down their husbands, putting down all the men. They were just kind of men haters, I guess. And they seem to have a problem, dealing with men. They seem to always have to have the upper hand. So once his grandmother finds out that he's been shooting birds and blah, 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 she takes the gun away from him, which, you know, I guess it has some sort of sentimental value because he did love his grandfather. And his grandfather got him that gun and taught him how to use it. And again, he's 15. So, yeah, I guess, you know, a lot of interaction with family, something he didn't get from males because his father left. So this was something that I think was kind of sentimental to him. It threw him in a rage because his grandmother took his damn gun. You're not doing this. I don't approve of this. You shooting birds. I don't approve of that. This ensued an argument The argument escalated to the point where he gets up, he leaves the room, he comes back with the gun, shoots his paternal grandmother in the head, and it said twice in the back, and it's also stated that he there were some stab wounds there. So this was a fit of rage. This was something where just a shot to the head that probably killed her, point blank range from a rifle, back of the head, probably killed her. No, two more shots to the back, and then there were stab wounds. Loving his grandfather the way he did, because his grandfather was not in the house at the time. He actually had been grocery shopping. And when he, Kemper that is, hears his grandfather pull up, it said that he killed him in the driveway. It seems weird to me. You know, you can just kill someone in the driveway, and it's probably during the day, not late, to where everyone's sleeping. Even so, a rifle going off, would probably alarm neighbors. But at any rate, kills his grandfather, and the reason being that he kills his grandfather is because he didn't want his grandfather to see his wife dead. He felt that it would give him a heart attack. So he was basically, what Kemper was saying was he basically killed his grandfather in order to spare him the pain of seeing his wife dead. So we can already get a picture of how old 15-year-old Kemp is. He then goes and calls his mother after doing this. His mother suggests, well, you need to turn yourself in. And that's exactly what he does. He contacts the police and sat there and waited, and he got put in custody. When questioned by authorities, Kemper said that, well, quote, he just wanted to see what it felt like to kill grandma. And that rage that I feel that he had towards his mother, and it is stated that this grandmother, Maud Matilda Huey Kemper, acted just alike. They were both very domineering women, always putting down the men in their life. And I think it was easy for him. At that point, I think it was easy for him. But he ends up getting arrested. And he goes to a place called Atascadero, not Tuscadero, like Pinky from Happy Days. I don't know how old of the crowd is listening, but Atascadero, which was pretty much a psychiatric hospital for basically the criminally insane or severely psychotic younger people. And he was put there when he was 15. Now, the psychiatrists, I should say, and the social workers, they disagree with the court's own psychiatrist's diagnosis. Now, the court's reports stated that he was, quote, no flight of ideas, no interference with thought, no expression of delusions or hallucinations, and no evidence of bizarre thinking. And he also, at 15, recorded an IQ of 136. Now, that's pretty damn high. A high IQ, I think, is said to be between 90 and 100, you know, right in that area. That could be off a little bit, but he was diagnosed there with having personality trait disturbance, passive-aggressive type. He was given a couple, you know, IQ tests over the course of his stay, which happened to be from the time he was 15 to the time he was 21. One of the other tests that he gave, he went even higher. He had a 145. Now, I kind of a little skeptical on IQ tests. I don't know how you actually do that, so I'm going to be skeptical. Now, the psychiatrist and, you know, CEOs, because this is a prison in a sense, but you're not just thrown into, you know, a cage and left alone. You're given psychiatric, you know, help. You're talking to doctors. They're trying to figure out what's going on. So, other prisoners, as well as the psychiatrist, would, you know, I mean, they loved him. He was said to be a model prisoner. And was actually trained to be an administer psychiatric, to administer psychiatric tests to other inmates. So he was like a, you know, an intern at this point, but was a patient. He had such a high IQ. And this kind of got him familiar with certain tests that were being done. And he ended up talking with a lot of sex offenders that were there. And through these tests, he got information. And some of the information, one example is some of these sex offenders stated that it was best to actually kill the woman after you raped her to avoid leaving witnesses. So he was getting pointers, pretty much. Now, on his 21st birthday, this is 1969, on his 21st birthday, he was released on parole. But here's where it gets a little weird for old Kemp. Against the recommendations of the psychiatrist, he was put back, and I think it's because he was on parole. They needed a, you know, stable address or whatnot. They didn't want him to take off. Although they, given his past, incarcerated, institutionalized, I can't see them thinking that he was a flight risk, or maybe they just didn't know. But they seemed to think highly of him, those working there. He was put back into the custody of his mother. So right back to square fucking one. I mean, this is almost like a Hollywood script. Right back to square one. Now you're right back in the same fucking predicament that you were in before. Where you have the overbearing mother who does nothing but belittle you, demasculate you, And it gets to the point that, well, he turns his anger, well, outward, I would say. Now, in the last report from his probation psychiatrist, it says, if I were to see this patient without having any history available or getting any history from him, I would think that we were dealing with a very well-adjusted young man who had initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illness. It is my opinion that he has a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of any danger to himself or to any member of society. And since it may allow him more freedom as an adult to develop his potential, I would consider it reasonable to have a permanent expunction of his juvenile records. They expunged his juvenile records, which means done. Those records are in the trash. The fact that you killed your grandparents, your paternal grandparents, your father's mom and dad, you killed them when you were 15. You go to this place, and this place says this. Expunge his records. He is a well-adjusted young man. Believe this. No. Yeah, you can't make this shit up. So, he moves back with his mother. I'm sure much to his dismay. Kemper attended a community college because, well, that was part of the parole requirements. And he actually wanted to be a police officer. But because of his size, at this point, he's 6'9". And, you know, right around, you know, probably 280, high 200s, 250 plus at least. He acquired the nickname Big Ed. Now, even though he was refused, he still had to, you know, get involved and see what was, you know, going on. He was very intrigued by the investigative process. He coined himself a friendly nuisance at a bar that was actually right across the street from the courthouse, I believe it was, called the Jury Room. A run-down bar, all the cops and bailiffs, maybe judges going over there having some drinks. And he would frequent this place and then become that friendly nuisance. And wouldn't talk about the crime itself, because he had stated that he watched a lot of cop shows, murder mysteries and things of that nature, and realize what not to do. One of the last things you want to do is start bringing up the murders that you've committed to try and get information about how they're investigating it. He said that was just the wrong thing to do, so he didn't bring it up. He just wanted to see, you know, how they were doing. He said he'd buy them a drink, they'd buy him a drink, and it kind of went on like that. And he also mentioned, you know, friendly nuisances when a cop says you're kind of a friendly nuisance. He figured out that, well, this means I'm not going to be high on the suspect list, because friendly nuisances are just that. They're a nuisance. They're friendly, but they're a fucking nuisance. So, yeah, you just, you know, I guess they kind of seen it as, you know, it's just, you know, Joe Public wanting to know about shit. He's friendly, but he's kind of getting on my fucking nerves. So, it was around this time that, well, his relationship, as I mean, no surprise here, his relationship with his mother becomes even more toxic and even more hostile. And he later described, you know, the arguments that he had, stating, quote, my mother and I started right in on horrendous battles, just horrible battles, violent and vicious. I've never been in such a vicious verbal battle with anyone. It would go to fist with a man, but this was my mother, and I couldn't stand the thought of my mother and I doing these things. She insisted on it, and just over stupid things. He says, I remember one roof raiser was over whether I should have my teeth cleaned. So, I mean, just explosive arguments over some of the most trivial things. I mean, I don't want to go get my teeth cleaned right now. Well, now everything blows up. So, eventually, he had saved up enough money and kind of moved to live with a friend in Alameda. And he began, unfortunately, he came across some financial difficulties. Being out on his own, he was only about, 22, 23, maybe. First time probably out on his own. And when he starts dating a 16-year-old later on, they were actually going to become engaged. And actually, they would later become engaged. So he had somebody, boom, that was, you know, what was going to love him, but something what was so fucked up in Kemp's head that was not going to happen. Now, we're going to skip ahead here, going up to 1972, the year old Otis was born. That's right, just threw my fucking age out there. This is when a little murder spree started. And it actually started with Marianne Pesci, no relation to Joe. I mean, I'm guessing. And Anita Lucchesa on May 7th, 1972. Now, see, this is what old Kemp would do. He noticed that riding around, there were a lot of hitchhikers at the time. So again, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, a lot of people, you know, just very trustworthy, a lot of hitchhikers, you know, going on. So he would literally take and bring weapons with him. He would have stuff shoved in all over the car. He would, you know, have a knife. He would have blankets and coats and, you know, to cover up bodies. He, you know, at one point, you know, I had a .22 pistol. And, well, he would test the waters of his own mind. Can I pick these two hitchhikers up, which in his words, he said they were all, you know, just that, you know, flower child, petite, pretty young ladies. Could he literally pick them up and not harm them? That was what he was kind of testing himself with. And he did that on a couple of occasions. This was not one of them. It said that, you know, they were hitchhiking. One had a sign that just simply said Stanford. Now, of course, he gets in. He had little nuances, that little things that he did that were not picked up by his, of course, unsuspecting passengers. What he would do, in some occasions, later on, he got a little smarter like this, but he would take a tube of chapstick, in the old cars, he'd go over there and act like he was checking the door, making sure it was shut tight, and drop that chapstick down in there, which would prevent the passenger from being able to pull the lever to open the door. It blocked it. He jammed the door. So once she was in, she was in. Now, other things that he did was he would look at his watch. As if he had, you know, showing the passengers, well, I have a place to be, so we have to hurry. Giving them, you know, not invoking any fear there. This is a guy who's got shit to do. And plus, the talk around town, you know, was all about, as he said, 9 times out of 10, more times than not, the conversation in the car would be about the things that he was fucking doing. Which came later on, of course. This is, you know, the spree that ended up with him being incarcerated. So he had these little things that he would do to try and ease the passengers. And so they're driving, get to a wooded area near Alameda, which he was actually pretty familiar with because, you know, he worked for the highway department. He couldn't be a cop, but, you know, he did his best. He was doing some way. So he knew the lay of the land. Let's just say that. And with it, and how he did this, I mean, he was able to take and, I guess, invoke conversation to keep his, you know, passengers from taking and being alerted to, hey, something's wrong. We're not going where we, you know, should be going. Why are we here? He was able to do that. He had every intention of raping and murdering these girls. But there was a serial rapist in Atascadero who said, don't leave a witness. Remember that guy? The one that he talked to while he was incarcerated there. So, and he had two people here. So he hurries up and he handcuffs one. Gets a hold of, or he handcuffs Pesci, gets a hold of Lucchesa, puts her in the fucking trunk. Sounds like an Eminem song. Her name was not Kim. And then proceeds to go back to the back seat and viciously stab this girl. I mean, just all outrage. He goes back to the back of the trunk. He's got blood on his hands, of course. It's even stated from him that it wasn't, you know, he said it was kind of a big knife, but he said when he hit her one time, he about pushed her all the way up to the roof of the car. So, vicious. All this anger from his mom is probably, you know, kicking in. He takes these, he goes back to the trunk. Old girl in the trunk sees there's blood on his hands. He says, oh, well, your friend there got a little mouthy. I kind of smacked her, and I think I broke her nose. She might be, you know, dying. I don't know about, you know, I guess if you hit somebody right in the, you know, in a certain way in the nose, you can probably kill him. But he proceeds to stab her to death, takes both of the bodies, then both dead people in the trunk, both dead girls in the trunk. Drives home. On the way home, he's stopped by a cop because he's got a broken taillight. And it said that he gets out of the car and he states, "Hey, what's the problem? You got a broken taillight, sir." "Oh, okay. You want me to open the trunk? And maybe we see if maybe it's a loose wire?" The cop at this point, he's going to open the trunk or offers to open the trunk. Okay. And in that trunk, what's this cop going to see? Two girls completely bludgeoned to death with a knife. I mean, just cut all the fuck up. What balls? So, cop's like, "Oh, man, this guy is... Okay, man, I'll give you a warning and get that fixed." Yeah. He got a fix. He didn't get that fix, maybe. She was Korean and Latvian heritage. She had missed the bus one day. She was 15 years old. She was a dance student. This happened September of 72, and she missed the bus. She's trying to get to her, you know, ballet class and whatnot. Boom, here comes Kemp, and picks her up. Now, you're absolutely not going to believe this, because I swear, for a split second, I thought to myself, the coup, she deserved what she got. And you'll understand. I know that's horrible to say, but I think she kind of, I don't know. She opened the door to it. Literally, this is what happens. Kemper pulls out a gun. He's already determined. She can't get out of the car. He did the little chapstick thing, probably. She can't get out of the car. He pulls a gun. She freaks out. He puts the gun away, puts it down on the floorboard, turns around and calms her down. They stop. For whatever reason, he gets out of the car and locks his keys in the car with Koo. So Koo's got his gun and the keys to the fucking car. What does Koo do? Koo opens the door for him and lets him back in. He proceeds to strangle her with a stocking. It just not a good. Now I agree, she did not deserve that. And I put that out there wrong. Maybe she didn't deserve to be murdered. But that was really not good thinking. It wasn't very cool. See what I did there? Cool. All right. For some reason she lets this guy who just pulled a gun on her, lets him back into the car. What did she think was going to happen? I don't know. He admired, you know, his little catch, like a fisherman, they said. He put her body in a trunk after he raped and killed her. Choked her unconscious first, of course, as I mentioned. Put her in a trunk, went and had a few drinks at a nearby bar. Exited the bar, opening his trunk, just again, admiring what he had done. And he takes the body back to his apartment and starts having sex with it. With the corpse, that is. Before dismembering disposing of all the remains in a similar manner as the previous two victims, that being Pesci and Lachesa. He wasn't done, and he didn't waste much time, because on January of 73, he moved back in with his mother and ended up picking up a young girl by the name of Cindy Shaw, or Cynthia Ann, but everyone called her Cindy, and took her to a secluded wooded area once again. Shot her with a .22 caliber pistol. Body back in the trunk. And put that body. And here's where it gets kind of weird. He put her body in his closet. And held that shit there for a while. And when his mom left for work, he's like, game on. Game the fuck on. He starts having sex with it. He notices a bullet, you know, by her temple that was still there. He decides, hey, I'm going to remove that. It continues, you know, having sex with, and then dismembering and decapitating it in his mother's bathtub. Now, maybe that was symbolic. But he kept this girl's head for several days. And regularly engaging in irrumatio. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's basically forcing a male, forcing their penis, or it could be the other way around. I mean, the head forcing. It's not willing. So if you unwillingly stick your head... Or stick your penis, if you're a guy, in somebody's head. Unwillingly, it's a little bit different than fellatio, because that now we're assuming that there was some willingness there, and both are, you know, involved. This was not the case, because her fucking head was off her body. So, he is fucking the decapitated head. And what's he do with this head? He takes and buries, I think, some of her remains as well. I think it was just her head. Put it in his mom's garden, right outside her window, with the head facing up. And he stated that his mom always wanted people to look up to her. Wow. That is just out of control. Out of control. All right. We're going to move along a little bit. Let's see. On February, just about a month later. And this is an ongoing thing. He gets into an argument with his mother, which always happened. And he decides to go on a killing spree. So, on the 5th of February, 1973, after a heated argument with his mother, Kemper left his house cruising UC. And see, it was said that because his mom was an administrative assistant there at UC and worked at UC, and would frequently tell him, oh, the girls there at UC, they would never have anything to do with you. Never. These girls wouldn't have shit to do with you. You're gargantuan. And they won't have anything to do with you. So it was almost like he kind of put that all together. Okay, my mom works at UC. She's always saying that none of these girls would ever have me. Maybe he kind of felt that way and decided to attack these co-eds, because it was a co-ed university. And I lost my place. So he comes across, again, after a heated argument, he comes across two girls, Rosalind Thorpe and Allison Liu. And they were on the UCSC campus, which was the University of California, Santa Cruz campus. And he said that Thorpe, Rosalind, entered the car first, which kind of gave a little bit of confidence to Liu, Allison Liu, to do the same. Then shot them both, wrapped their bodies in blankets. He proceeded to leave, and I believe this is when he encountered some guards. And nothing there. He even states he should have been caught the first 24 hours after the very first murders, that being Pesci and Lucchesa. He said within 24 hours, he should have been busted. And he brought his victims back to his mother's house, beheaded them in the car, and then carried the headless corpse into the house to have sex with him. Then dismembered him, took some bullets out that he shot him with, because, well, you didn't want to be identified, and got rid of their remains. Some remains were actually found in Eden Canyon a week later. Unbelievable, this guy. Now we're getting to the crescendo. We're getting to the big part. On April 20th, 420. Who figured that, man? If old Kemp maybe would have just had a joint on 420, maybe this wouldn't have happened. His mom went to a party. His mom at this point is about 52 years old. Goes to a party. She's getting a little saucy. Comes home, makes a little bit of noise, and wakes Kemp up. Now, Kemp comes into her room. She apparently is there reading a book. The first thing out of her mouth was, I suppose you're going to want to sit up all night and talk now. Because, again, as I mentioned in the beginning, she did not like this child. It seems weird to say that a mother would not like or love or not even like her own child. That was her. And Kemper stated that he simply said, no, good night. A little bit later, as she was asleep or going to sleep, he took a claw hammer, which, you know, normal hammer, you know, claw hammer, and, beat her to death. But it didn't stop there. He had so much anger for this woman over the years and what she had done to him. He decapitated her. He got some head. And used it as a dartboard. He put it up on the mantle. He stated that he screamed at it for hours, throwing darts at it, and then just completely destroying it. Cut her tongue out, cut her larynx out, and put them in the garbage disposal. Now, here's a funny thing, and hearing him talk about this, it's kind of obvious why he did it like that. I mean, his mom was always bad-mouthing him, putting him down, demasculating him, belittling him. So he figures, I'm going to rip your fucking tongue out. I'm going to take your larynx, all right? Even though your head is severed from your body, I'm going to take that, and I'm going to throw it in the garbage disposal, because that's what I think all you said to me was. Everything that comes out of your mouth is fucking garbage. Well, here's the thing. The garbage disposal couldn't really, you know, break up the vocal cords. And kind of shot some of the tissue and whatnot back into the sink. He stated that seemed appropriate. As much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years, that boom, here he throws her larynx and tongue back in the, you know, garbage disposal, or in the garbage disposal, and the garbage disposal spits it out. He said it seemed appropriate. Now, his mom had a you know, actually a good friend, and beforehand he put his mom's corpse in a closet and went out and had some beers. When he returned, he decided he was going to invite one of his mom's friends over. His mom's best friend, as a matter of fact. So they probably hung out a lot. She would be the first one to realize that Clarnell was gone, was something was wrong. So he figured, I have to take her out. Remember, no witnesses. So he invites her over. Her name was Sarah Taylor Hallett, otherwise known as Sally. She was 59 years old. He invited her over, for a dinner and a movie. When she arrived, strangled, decapitated, and spent the night with her dead body. He put her corpse in a closet and left a note to the police, and it said, approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday, no need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, quote-unquote, murderous butcher. And the reason I mention quote-unquote is because this is what his mother would call him. Would blame him because she hadn't had sex for 6-7 years. She couldn't get the dick, so she blamed her son because he was already convicted of killing his father's parents. It goes on to say, it was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents. Just a lack of time. I got things to do. Now, he left the scene. Didn't, you know, he was trying to actually get a chase. He wanted to be caught. He was hoping that this is what would happen. So he takes off and he starts driving, hoping that he's going to be recognized by law enforcement, that he's going to be picked up. He ends up at a phone booth and calls the cops, confesses to the murders of his mother and Hallett. But they didn't take his call seriously and told him to call back at a later time. So Kemper obliged. Several hours later, he calls back and asked to speak to a cop that he actually knew, maybe one that he had talked with at the jury room, one that he had bought a beer for. He then confessed to that cop of killing his mother and her best friend. And, well, at that point, they knew they had, you know, who they needed. And he just sat there and waited to be arrested. Kemper said later on, the original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real or emotional purpose. It was just a pure waste of time, emotionally. I couldn't handle it much longer. toward the end there, I started feeling the folly of the whole damn thing. And at the point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said to hell with it and called it all off. And he's been locked up ever since. He was indicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder, May 7th, 1973. He was given a public defender, so you know he had a good fucking chance there. But he had already admitted to all this. So the only thing that this public defender could really do was take and say, oh, he was, you know, he's not guilty by reason of insanity. Well, that didn't work too well. He was not that guy. In California, it stated, to establish a defense on the grounds of insanity, it must be clearly proved that at the time of committing of the act, the party accused was laboring under such a defect of reason from disease of the mind and not to know the nature and quality of the act he was doing, or if he did know it, that he did not know he was doing what was wrong. That was not the case. It was very obvious of why he was doing these things. He stated it because his mother was this way, because his mother was that way. That he almost made it that the driving force in this murderous spree was his mother. And maybe that's what it was. On November 8th, 1973, the sixth man, sixth woman jury convened for 5 hours before declaring Kemper sane and guilty on all counts. He asked for the death penalty, requesting death by torture. He wanted to be tortured to death. However, with a moratorium placed on capital punishment, I think I'm pronouncing that right, by the Supreme Court at that time, he instead received 7 years to life for each count, with these terms to be served concurrently, and was sentenced to the California Medical Facility. Now, he actually, even after all of this, was a pretty, he was still liked by the inmates, by other people. He was in jail, actually, with an individual, Herbert Mullen, who I tossed around, maybe doing a podcast about him about 2-3 weeks ago. And good old Charlie. But he didn't really like Mullen a whole lot. And he called him. He said he's just a cold-blooded killer, killing everybody he saw for no good reason. Now, if you know the story of Herbert Mullen, you understand that Kemper really kind of had a... he had a point there. Kemper, it said that he manipulated him. He intimidated Mullen, who... You know, Mullen was only about... You know, he was under 6 foot. Mullen apparently had a habit of singing and bothering people when they're trying to watch TV. So, Kemper throws a glass of water on him to shut him up. Kemper states, quote, "Then, when he was a good boy, I'd give him peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective, because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavioral modification treatment." He knew about these treatments that were being done at Atascadero. He studied all that. This is a very intelligent person. He had in 2015... he experienced a stroke and was declared medically disabled. That was when he got his, first, I guess, infraction. and that was for failing to provide a urine sample. And that was his only infraction. not that that makes him a good guy or anything, but his next parole hearing, the next time he'll be eligible will be 2024. So not long, if you want to visit him. Not long. All right. Here's a little bit of Edmund Kemper. And don't forget, new Amityville Horror, but a prequel called Amityville 1974. Talking about the DeFeo murders there. My old Ronnie DeFeo Jr. Excited for that. They're starting to film this November. And so I'm excited about that. Do you want to mention that? I know people have probably heard of this, but poor Dave Mustaine, if you're a Megadeth fan, diagnosed with throat cancer. He seems to be very optimistic with his public response to this diagnosis, so wish him the best. If you don't like his music, it don't matter. You never want to see anybody have to suffer through that shit. All right, with that, calling this a wrap. Episode 31 in the books. That's it. Man, I just talked my ass off. Edmund Kemper. All right, be back here in just a few days. I'm a little off my schedule, but I will get it back. Thank you guys for listening. Otis B. Dreads, signing off. They're coming in to the Insane Asylum. Trying to put me in one of those funny jackets that helped me scratch my back. All right, I'm out.
Things no one knows. We're going to die.